Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This week, we are bringing you a special bonus episode in which we respond to a whole lot of listener questions and give you guys updates on some of the cases we've covered in the past. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Hey guys, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
So before we dive into the questions we've gotten, I just want to give our listeners a heads up. Make sure you tune in next week, because next week we launch into a long series, a new wrongful conviction case, and you don't want to miss it.
In full disclosure, I am not sure at this point how we're going to number our episodes, because I think this is season 3, but that may be confusing given the number of arcs we had recently.
Yeah. Susan's taking a lead on this investigation, and knowing Susan's investigative prowess, I'm guessing we're going to have a whole lot of episodes. So let's dive into the questions, and I'll start with the first one. It comes from Andrea Seabee, and she says, my question for the upcoming episode is whether SCOTUS's ruling on cell phone evidence will have any effect on Adnan's case specifically, as well as on other cases that relied on this type of evidence. Thanks for everything you do. So maybe we should first talk about that ruling.
Yeah, this was a ruling by the Supreme Court in a case called Carpenter versus United States, and the question dealt with law enforcement obtaining location records based upon cell phone use. And this is a question under the Fourth Amendment. Basically, the question was, there's a doctrine known as the third-party doctrine. So, for instance, let's say my neighbor breaks into my house and discovers drugs. They could turn it over to the police, who could then use that against me without violating the Fourth Amendment. And that's what the state claimed in this case, that, for instance, a cell phone company could turn over cell tower records in response to a subpoena, and then the state could use those against the defendant. And what the Supreme Court said is, at least for getting records for more than 7 days, that that requires a warrant. And that, in other words, the police need to have probable cause, they have to get a warrant before they can get those location records in a given case. And so going forward, of course, that could impact any number of criminal investigations where the police are trying to use these cell tower records. The big question, which impacts potentially Adnan and other defendants who might have retrials based upon older cases, is this Carpenter opinion going to be retroactive? In other words, would it apply to cases that were handled before this opinion was issued by the Supreme Court? And that's an open question. There was a similar case a few years ago, which was Riley versus California, and that dealt with whether the police could search a cell phone as an instant to a lawful arrest, and they found that they couldn't. And some courts have found that that opinion is retroactive. Others have found that it's not. So it depends how the courts interpret this as to whether this would apply to older cases that are being reopened.
And as a reminder, in Anand's case, the cell phone location data, well, there's a question of when exactly it was obtained by the police. But when they later requested it, albeit already with knowledge of how many cell sites they were looking for, they used an administrative subpoena, which is not the same as a warrant. And if done today, would not satisfy Carpenter's requirements.
My understanding is that the SCOTUS ruling, it doesn't address that. So like you said, Colin, it doesn't address the issue of whether this would be retroactive, just kind of leaves it open. Was that deliberate, you think? I mean, why wouldn't they specify whether or not they think this should be applied retroactively or just for future cases?
They typically don't.
They didn't have to decide it.
They typically don't do that. So like Riley versus California, the case I mentioned, they didn't do it either. It's a two-part test the courts look at when they're interpreting it and applying it. So the first is this a rule that's substantive? And that wouldn't apply here. That is essentially if, say, the Supreme Court found marijuana is legal and can't be a crime to possess it, that would be retroactive. The second is this a watershed rule of criminal procedure that's central to determining guilt or innocence? And so that's the question. In other words, when we're looking at the police obtaining these cell tower records and trying to determine location, is that central to determining guilt and innocence such that police have to get a warrant before they get those records or not? Or is it something that's more collateral and not as important and therefore does not apply retroactively?
So the question about whether or not it applies retroactively will be litigated in different circuits, basically, going forward?
Yeah, and that's what happened in Riley versus California. Some courts found it was retroactive, some found it was not. And then to Susan's point, you know, we're not entirely sure of the timeline in Adnan's case, but at the time they got these cell tower records, they didn't have, according to them at least, they hadn't talked to Jay, they hadn't talked to Jen, they didn't have much evidence. So there would at least be a plausible argument here at a third trial that those records wouldn't be admissible because they were unlawfully obtained.
The next question comes from Jonathan Leatherwood. He says, please, please let me know how to write to Joey Watkins. And if you'd like to write to Joey from our season 2 case in Rome, Georgia, you can reach him probably the easiest way is on JPay. If you go to jpay.com, you can sign up for an account and you can reach him at Joseph Watkins, Georgia Department of Corrections. And his number is 000-108-6941. So if you enjoyed that series, and I know you'd want to hear from anyone who listened to it, so feel free to reach out to him.
There is a slight cost to JPay, correct?
Yes. Yeah. You have to pay per an email, which I do not know the exact amount right now, but.
Right, right. And then I think you have to front load it so that the incarcerated person can write back. But it's a pretty efficient system. I wish we could do it for, I mean, but it's not available like in all facilities, right? It's just in certain places, so. All right, so I just bolded this question. I thought I wanted to just respond to it because I thought we'd give listeners a general idea of how we decide to take a case. The next question comes from Kelly Wright. I'm wondering if you have considered doing a season on the Lacey Peterson case. I really have my doubts on if justice was served there, and I would love to see what you can dig up on it. So I thought we could give a little bit of insight about how we decide what cases to take. We obviously are solicited. We're approached by different organizations or individuals to take a look at cases. Sometimes it's the family members of somebody who's a defendant. Sometimes it's the attorney. And then sometimes we go on our own and seek them out. But generally speaking, we do try to avoid cases that already have had a ton of coverage, have what it seems like, at least, you know, fairly robust legal representation. It seems like the defendant, you know, has had chances or is, you know, like their case has already been examined. And you know, so that's one of the things. So that's why we would probably never look at the Lacey Peterson case, because, I mean, this is something that's been examined by many people. Scott Peterson has had, you know, robust representation throughout all of this. I don't know. Any other thoughts you guys want to add on that?
Yeah. I mean, part of what Undisclosed can do and what we can do to help defendants and hopefully make a difference in how the criminal justice system operates is to put a spotlight on cases that are overlooked and forgotten. So cases that are already out there in the public eye, already being examined, whether they're worthy cases or not, we feel like our efforts are best spent elsewhere.
Yeah. Two of the cases that I'm taking a look at right now, in both cases, the defendants, they don't have attorneys. They can't afford counsel at this point. So if we can assist in that way, I think that's what we prefer to put our resources.
Yeah. And that's another consideration for a lot of them. An ideal case is one where there is an attorney representing them and we're able to coordinate our efforts in large part to make sure we're not going to hurt the defendant accidentally, that we don't somehow do something to undermine his own rights or his chances at a new trial. But a lot of these cases that come to us and the ones that we think are worth looking into and worth giving some exposure to are ones where defendants are, like Rabia said, they can't afford an attorney. They don't have representation. They have no other options. It's hard working those cases, but a lot of the times it's turned out that we've had more so that than actually the people with attorneys lately.
Our next question comes from Twitter user at GentlemanMMA, and he asks, in the case of the woman accused of killing her husband, does she get the property back that she lost if she is exonerated? And this question relates to the Pam Lanier case out of North Carolina. And of course, that was the case where she was convicted of murdering her husband. And under the state's Slayer statute, it said that she can't inherit the husband's property because if you're found guilty of murder, you forfeit your rights to the property. And as far as I can tell, and looking through that statute and other statutes, there's no mechanism under the law to get that property back. And it's different from, say, paying a fine to the state and you're exonerated later and you get that money back, because this is property that went to other family members and there's not a mechanism to get that property back from them. So if she is released, and we hope she is, there's probably not a mechanism for her to recover under her husband's will, because that simply is not in place under the statute.
That's awful.
Blue Apron delivers farm fresh ingredients and step-by-step recipes right to your door. They offer three plans: the two-person meal plan, the family meal plan that serves four, and their wine plan, which features 6 bottles of wine from renowned winemakers delivered monthly. And here's a cool new feature that Blue Apron recently introduced. If you're on the family plan, you can order items from the two-person plan and vice versa. So my wife and I have the family meal plan, and we're pescatarians, but she's allergic to salmon. So next week, the fish dish in the family plan is miso glazed salmon, but no problem. We can just jump over to the two-person plan and order the spicy Veracruz-style shrimp with brown rice. And for those of you who might have been on the fence about trying Blue Apron, now's the ideal time to get started. Blue Apron has teamed up with best-selling cookbook author Chrissy Teigen to bring some of her favorite recipes to make at home, including chipotle lime chicken fajitas and pork banh mi. And as with all the recipes, Blue Apron delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes right to your door. I've been cooking with Blue Apron for a couple of years, and every meal has been delicious and easy to make. And now, you too can try Blue Apron. You can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/undisclosed. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed to get your first three meals free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
So the next couple questions actually have to do with the Haymon Lee case. They come from listener Marianne Jarvis. Her first question is, I remember at my school back in 1999, they had CCTV pointing to the car park area. Was there any CCTV pointing towards the school car park where the bus loop or Hayes car could have been? It's interesting. Today, if you go to Woodlawn High School, there are cameras on the outside of the school. My understanding, and I believe Adnan's attorney looked into this, and I think also Sarah Koenig looked into this, is that they did not have cameras on the outside of the school in 1999. However, we do know that there was a 7-Eleven right across the street. So as you exit the school, like literally the drive that the little, you know, entrance to the school, it's right next to that Woodlawn Library, and right in front of you is a 7-Eleven. And 7-Eleven did have cameras, external cameras as well as internal cameras, and one of them did, in fact, point in the direction of the school. This was not discovered until many, many years later, of course, and it was way too late to recover any video at that time. But what's interesting is I spoke to the owner of that 7-Eleven, at least when he doesn't own it now, but in 99 he did. And he said that at the time the police did come to ask for any video footage, but he cannot remember if he actually turned anything over, if they found anything but he does remember being visited by the police in the aftermath of her disappearance.
And the reason I'd be particularly interested in this kind of footage is that police would have been seeking it out, or should have been seeking it out, when Hay was missing as a missing person, long before they found her body, long before they knew it was a murder case, even before they were particularly concerned about this case and maybe still thought that it was just a runaway. Obtaining that video footage would have been an obvious first step in the early days, which means the footage would likely have still existed. After the body was found, that was more than, or almost 30 days out. And at that point, maybe there would not have been footage saved. Maybe it had been rewritten, or maybe it would have been already deleted from whoever would have had it. But yeah, in that first week, if they got anything, it probably would have still been there.
I do wonder, I know if you guys recall, that initially, the initial reports that went out after her disappearance, they all seemed to say the same thing, which was that Haymon Lee was last seen leaving the school around 3 o'clock. Do you remember that?
Shortly after 3. And then the question is, was that Debbie? Were they basing that entirely off of Debbie's statements?
Right. I don't know what they were basing that.
Or did they have more?
Yeah, was there footage that could have shown that? I've always wondered about why that was the official time given, like right after her disappearance.
On the other hand, initially at least, the police didn't take Hayes' disappearance that seriously and didn't consider it a likely crime. So it's possible that they didn't seek it out.
Yeah. All right. So next question is, what are your thoughts on what Mr. A witnessed and J says when he says Jeff G picked him up from Woodlawn? Do you think Jeff G could have been a third man? Wait, who is Mr. A? I'm confused.
Mr. A is the guy who saw the youngish African-American man sort of within a mile of the burial location.
Remember Mr. S.
My thoughts are that we'll never know because it was not looked into very much at the time. And so much time has passed that there's no way to really verify anything in terms of dates, in terms of what he saw. It could mean something. It could just easily not. And at this point, there's no way to ever figure that out.
And is Jeff G one of the people who has passed away? There's a couple of folks who have passed away. I can't remember.
Yeah, Jeff G has passed away. My thoughts on him is that he had nothing to do with anything. It's just that his house was in a location that fit the police's incorrect itinerary for that day. They'd written down some of the cell sites wrong, and in order to make it fit Jay's story, they had to have Jay go to another location, which conveniently was his friend Jeff G lived, so why not go there?
And just to note in the question, it says, when he says Jeff G picked him up from Woodlawn, actually in that pre-interview, in the first police interview, he says Jeff G drove him to Woodlawn to see Stephanie after school. And yeah, I think I agree with Susan on this. It's based upon the cell towers. I don't think Jeff G had anything to do with the events of January 13th.
Okay, so the next question is, being a media student, I find it odd the original videotape was never found of Hayes' interview. I only say this because normally a local news channel would have this archived. It doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have it, but to not have it on record is strange.
Yep.
Well, yes.
It's maybe not now that they don't have it is strange, but yeah, it's, I hate this tape. I hate how it's maddening and we have no answers. And again, probably never will. We have the tape itself. We have some of it anyway, that was later played on local news at the time of her disappearance, or when she was reported murdered, I believe, but we don't actually have the original one, and we don't know when it was filmed, more importantly.
Yeah, yeah, that's the craziest part of it. Like, nobody has any idea. I mean, we've tried to contact the actual reporter, we've tried to contact the station, multiple people have, and there's just no record of, like, when that reporter actually visited the school, so that further muddies the timeline of what actually happened on the 13th, and whether certain things actually took place that day or a whole nother day.
And you know who else didn't know what day that was filmed on? The police. Because in their notes at one point, they're writing down like the list of to-do things, and it includes like a, what day was that filmed? So I don't know if they ever answered that question, but it's possible that no one's ever actually known what day this took place on.
All right, final question. Will any more of the DNA evidence be tested as there was so much lacking?
I assume that if there is evidence they can test for DNA, it will be tested probably within the next 2 years based on one of two things. Either A, the Court of Appeals of Maryland will take the state's appeal and will reverse the order granting a new trial, meaning Adnan then would have his conviction reinstated. And of course, the defense at that point would now move for DNA testing. The other option is either the Court of Appeals of Maryland denies cert, doesn't hear the appeal, or does hear the appeal and uphold the new trial. And at that point, I assume that either the state or the defense are going to test the DNA. Probably at that point, the state, I guess, would test the DNA.
Yeah, if the DNA exists, right?
Right, if that evidence is still out there, yeah.
Next question, also about the same case, comes from Karen South Jones. What does the outcome of the Baltimore City Attorney primary mean for Adnan? So that primary took place June 26th, yesterday, as we're recording. And there were three candidates. I mean, there was the incumbent, Marilyn Mosby. Then you had the two challengers, Thiru Vignaraja and Ivan Bates. Thiru Vignaraja has been the pro bono prosecutor, special prosecutor, on Adnan's case for the last few years. And I think he didn't win. he came in third. Ivan Bates also did not win, which is, you know, Bates running was the reason I was really paying attention, because Ivan Bates, who was in fact a prosecutor for about 6 years in Baltimore City, but for the majority of his career has been a criminal defense attorney now. But he had publicly stated that he did not think there was enough evidence to proceed with another trial against Adnan, that he would drop charges, but also that he would reopen the investigation, which I think was a key interest of mine, at least. Anyhow, Marilyn Mosby has now won again. So she's won a second term as DA, and I don't really know what this means. I think it's kind of like, you know, we're maintaining the status quo, basically. I don't think that, given what I know of how she's handled other matters, including the ongoing Keith Davis stuff, I don't think she would be inclined to drop charges and reopen the investigation, as Mr. Bates had said. Maybe she'd be inclined to offer a plea deal if the case came to her. But I also have been told that there is a possibility that she might even, I mean, if she ends up, like, let's say, hiring Thiru Vignaraja, the same prosecutor for her office, because she's going to hire more prosecutors, that could also change the game. I don't know. I'm not sure what this means, but in a way, it kind of doesn't really change much of anything. I would expect a plea deal coming from her, but what do you guys think?
Yeah, well, to your point, Rabia, that's one interesting thing. I think it was Bates himself who said that Thiru was in the race to sort of siphon votes away from him.
And he did.
And sort of has this agreement that he would be hired by Mosby, maybe as deputy district attorney, because as weird as it is for Thiru to be this pro bono state's attorney for the appeal, you couldn't even imagine or fathom him as a private attorney prosecuting this case at a third trial. So in a crazy way, the way that this all unfolded is if this goes to a third trial, I guess Theroux could actually be the trial prosecutor if he ends up being hired by Mosby's office.
And I feel like that's something he wants. I think that if he was hired by her office, that would put us in a position where I wouldn't expect a plea anymore. I would expect someone like him to say, we're taking this to trial again.
Right. Or at least a plea bargain offer that was ridiculous and just sort of something that would never be accepted. That I think that would certainly increase the odds of that happening with him being in the office.
Yeah. So let's see what his next career move is. He is right now with DLA Piper. And I don't know, maybe he'll stick it with private practice. The next question comes from Brooke Weatherly. She asks, and spoiler here, by the way, that she's watching The Staircase on Netflix. So can someone please explain how Michael Peterson got out of jail the next day after the judge decided on retrying him, but Adnan is still in prison?
This is an oversimplified answer, but again and again, it's not unusual to see the system work one way for most people and a different way for rich white old men.
Yeah, so Peterson was given, looking back to the history, this was in 2011. It was found the blood spatter expert at trial had lied about his credentials and his testimony history in court, and that led to the conviction being thrown out. And so then Peterson was released. It was $300,000 bail and then house arrest with a tracking anklet. And of course, in this case, we know that after Judge Welch granted Adnan a new trial, the defense moved for bail in his release pending trial. And what Judge Welch found was this is still being appealed in the Maryland appellate courts, and so we're not going to release you pending that. And that's right, exactly as Susan notes, different outcomes in different cases. And it's something where that could impact the point we were discussing a minute ago, which is that leverage the state has in terms of a plea bargain if this is upheld. It's increased, certainly, if this is a case where Adnan's in prison pending that third trial as opposed to if he's released pending that third trial.
All right. Next question, also about the same case, comes from Michael O'Neill. What are your thoughts on the state taking 3+ years before setting retrial date in the Michael Peterson case? Basically, he had to take an Alford plea to get his life back. The state was cruel.
This definitely relates to something in Adnan's case for the same reason I just was discussing, which is you have a right under the Constitution to a speedy trial. Many states also have statutes relating to a speedy trial, though, as I covered in an episode, North Carolina has probably the worst state statute in terms of a speedy trial. But in North Carolina and Maryland, what it's been found is that right to a speedy trial does not apply in the same way if it's a retrial after a conviction is thrown out. And that can lead and has led in both states to the state really dragging their feet and delaying that retrial for 1, 2, 3 years. And as Michael notes in this tweet, this really probably greased the wheels on Peterson taking this offer plea. And you could imagine the exact same thing happening in Adnan's case where he wants this third trial and there's this enticing plea bargain. And really the state could drag it out and say, you're going to be in prison and here's this deal, take it or leave it. And you might sit in prison for years, even if you might eventually win at that third trial.
Or even if the state does not really intend to take it to trial in the end.
All right, so the next question comes to us from Anne S. Do you think Undisclosed could do an arc on the Keith Davis Jr. case at all? With all interlinking with Freddie Gray and Adnan Syed, I'm sure listeners would be interested. So, you know, I've actually thought about this. I mean, I've been thinking about, there is a lot of overlap. I mean, Susan, you're also looking at another Baltimore case that, we're probably going to cover in the future.
Yeah, I know we just said that we typically stay away from high-profile cases, but if we were going to make an exception,
this might be it.
Yeah.
For those who are not familiar with the Keith Davis Jr. case, I don't know all the details. So basically, he's going to be retried for the fourth time, I think, in September. There was a mistrial was just declared in his third trial. He keeps getting re-prosecuted for, he's been accused of shooting a police officer, I think. Was it a police officer or security guard? I can't remember. But either way, there is evidence, it seems to suggest, that he's innocent of the crime. He maintains his innocence. And there's an entire movement. In fact, Ivan Bates, who was running for DA, worked on Keith Davis's defense as well to get him a new trial at one point. So, you know, fourth trial coming up, which is, that's a lot to go through.
Mm-hmm. My hope is that there'd be no need for Undisclosed to cover it. And he gets acquitted.
Yeah. And the link to Adnan's case is there is this surveillance video footage of likely the person who committed this crime. And defense counsel says this was never turned over to us. And in fact, the person in the video does not resemble Mr. Davis and claims that this was a Brady violation. And the Baltimore detective who handled that evidence and apparently gave some contradictory testimony on the stand is Detective Mark Vini. And if you remember that name, that was from the post-conviction proceeding in Adnan's case. He's the person who interviewed security guard Steve at the library and had him, quote unquote, sign this affidavit saying that he had not seen Adnan on January 13th. And of course, there was this whole big scene at the PCR where Steve came in and testified and said, that's not what I said. And what Vini was saying about my statement is a complete misrepresentation. So that's the thing that ties these two cases mm-hmm. together.
All right. So the next question comes to us from Doc Proc. Listening to Ronnie Long episodes, can a victim deny participating in a suspect lineup given the evidence that they're not so trusted and seem to incarcerate the wrong person? Interesting question. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because I actually just did a blog post about a similar issue in another case. There's a rule of evidence. It's Federal Rule of Evidence 801 D1C, and basically every state has a counterpart. And it says that if a witness testifies at trial, their prior statement of identification, whether at a photo array, a lineup, et cetera, can come into evidence. And this was actually a case where the witnesses came in and said, I don't remember making an identification at all, which was sort of weird. And it might have been, in fact, similar to what we have in the question here, where they doubted the veracity of what they did and the reliability. But what the rule says is even if you take the stand and say, I have no recollection whatsoever of making this identification, that identification evidence can come in order to convict the defendant. And that's what happened in this case. The only evidence against him was identification evidence. The two witnesses who made the ID said, I don't remember making the ID at all. The evidence came in and the defendant was convicted.
I've also seen a few cases kind of recently, actually, where there is a lot of dispute over what identification is. If the victim was... if the words I said amounted to identification, or was it something less than that? Did they say, for instance, well, they look similar, or I think I recognize that clothing or body part or item? The cops may record that as identification, but the witness might, in their head, very truthfully say, no, I never identified anything. I just, you know, kind of thought aloud about what looked similar, what didn't.
Next question comes to us from Gregory Finnegan, and he asks, given the time that has passed in many of these cases, Adnan, Ronnie, Joey, and the diminished chance of any political blowback to sitting DAs, what is the state's continued interest in upholding and fighting quite clear miscarriages of justice?
The system always protects itself. That's what it's designed to do.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, is that it? Is that enough yeah. of... I mean, you could think about like the resources the state throws at doing this continuously, right?
But imagine the resources it would take if the floodgates opened up. They have to limit it.
Floodgates opened up how? Like, let's say they decided, we're not going to continue to appeal in Adnan's case. We're just going to stop right here and we're going to like offer a plea. We're just going to like, you know, we're just going to let this go one way or the other. What floodgate would that open?
If you expand or recognize the rights of one incarcerated defendant, that can apply, in most cases it will apply, not just them, but to others. The broader the rules are, the more avenues for relief that are offered, the bigger the workload.
Do you think it's also a deterrent?
Yeah, yeah.
To show that, look, this is how hard we will fight back.
Don't even try,
yeah.
And there was just very recently the James Owens case, which I've many times compared to Adnan's case, where these two men... James Thompson and James Owens were allegedly involved in a rape and a murder, and Mr. Owens was recently exonerated and got $9 million from the state for a wrongful conviction. And that's a concern in these cases, the state's pocketbook, that if they... Now, certainly, as Robbie notes, a plea deal, and that was an issue in the Owens case as well, could, you know, help insulate the state from a lawsuit, but not completely. And they're concerned about what could happen if Adnan, in this case, is exonerated, about what type of settlement he could get.
So we're going to move on to giving updates in some of the cases we've covered in the past. Let's start with Pam Lanier. Colin, what's going on?
Yeah, and so as I noted earlier in the episode, Pam Lanier, this is the case of the turkey farmers, where the wife in North Carolina was accused and convicted of poisoning her husband. And in our fourth episode, I spoke to a number of experts who talked about his ingestion of the turkey medication and how that would fully explain his arsenic poisoning. And that's progressing along nicely. Actually, just earlier this week and last week, I was in contact with her attorney and the experts, and they're in the process now of completing expert affidavits. And so the hope is later in this summer to submit those in North Carolina in a motion for appropriate relief, which would be for a new trial. And we're hopeful about our prospects.
So let's talk about what's happening with the Ronnie Long case. Any movement there, Colin?
Yeah, and so Ronnie Long, again, this is the case of the man in Concord, North Carolina, who in 1976 was convicted of rape and burglary. And as we revealed in the fourth episode of that series, there was a bunch of evidence the state hadn't turned over, such as evidence showing that there were a number of State Bureau of Investigation reports that tended to exculpate Mr. Long, that fibers and hairs, et cetera, from the crime scene weren't found in his clothes. We're expecting any day now the district court, this is in federal court now, and we expect the district court in North Carolina any day now to rule on the Brady claims raised by Mr. Long. That might be in favor of the defense or the state. Probably, inevitably, this is going to go up to the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, and a three-judge panel of the Fourth Circuit will likely have the final say on whether these were Brady violations.
Fingers crossed for Ronnie Long. Such an egregious miscarriage of justice. All right, a non-update. So right now what's happened is that appellate documents have been given to the Court of Appeal judges. And so what that means is the state has asked for leave to appeal. Basically, they're asking the Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in Maryland, to take this appeal. The court can deny or grant cert. If they grant cert, then that means that there will be a full appellate process in the Court of Appeals. There will probably be a hearing this fall. The whole thing will probably take a year. If they deny cert, then that could be the end of the road for the state, unless they decide to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which, I don't know, seems unlikely. But what does the timeline look like on this decision about whether to grant or deny cert, Colin?
Yeah, so the next conference of the judges is July 26th. They could potentially resolve the issue before that, but at the latest, at the July 26th conference, the judges will meet and they'll make a decision. And so again, there are seven judges at the Court of Appeals. It takes three of them to grant cert for them to hear the case. And so within a few days of July 26th, we'll know whether the Court of Appeals has denied cert, and that's the end of the road in state court for the state, or whether the court is granted cert and we can prepare for additional briefing and oral arguments in the fall.
I think so. Steve Klepper, who is a Maryland appellate attorney, he's been tweeting a lot about the prospects on granting or denying cert. And I remember a while ago, you and him both kind of did like a calculation about whether it seems like, you know, what are the possibilities here? But then he kind of recalibrated recently. I didn't follow it very closely, though, but Do you know what he's saying in terms of, because there was a dissent, it seems more likely that they might grant cert, but maybe not.
Yeah, so both he and I reached the same calculation. He was looking at both civil and criminal cases. I was looking at just criminal cases, but the number is the same. In the last several years, in 80% of cases where there's a dissent at the Court of Special Appeals, the Court of Appeals has granted cert and heard the appeal. And then what both of us recognized and looked at was to say, well, the reason that happens is, you know, typically there's a roadmap. The dissenting opinion has sided with the losing party. That losing party then files a cert petition that essentially restates the argument in the dissent. And of course, with this dissenting opinion, the Court of Appeals wants to hear the case. But what both of us have noted is that Thiru, in crafting his cert petition, did not essentially used the language of Judge Grafe, who dissented. He went into this whole alibi by routine argument to say, you know, should the court have found that Gutierrez was effective because she shouldn't have to have spoken to Asia McClain in formulating her strategy, because her strategy was alibi by routine and Asia McClain would contradict alibi by routine. And what both of us found was there's no phrase alibi by routine in any case or any journal that exists in the law. This is something that Thiru himself has created. And in the cert petition, he, you know, presents no reasons why the court should accept this. And so both of us sort of have lowered that 80% and said, it's a coin flip. At this point, based on what Theroux did in his petition, he really hamstrung the state. And there's still a good chance that the court will agree to hear it, but it's really lowered the odds from the typical case when there's a dissent.
Why do you think he deviated from the dissent? I thought he was just going to, like, that would be his template.
Because Grace's reasoning had problems. I don't think he wanted to adopt them as his own position.
For me, I just think he could have been general. And that's sort of what I just said in a blog post, is he could have simply said, did the Court of Special Appeals err by finding that Gutierrez was reasonable in her efforts to contact Asia McLean? That would cover alibi routine. It would cover thinking she's a liar. It would cover thinking her alibi is not specific enough. There was no reason for Theroux in his petition to really focus and have specifically argument alibi routine. So I don't know why he was so specific, but specific in a way that was sort of creating new law.
Well, one way or the other, I guess we will find out how this is going to go in about the next month. So that's not too far off. All right. For the listeners whose questions we didn't get to, apologies for that. Maybe we'll be able to answer some of them in the future, and some of them probably we just won't ever touch. But you can maybe try to tweet at us, and maybe you get something out of us on some of these issues.
Thanks so much for listening to this special episode of Undisclosed. Next Monday, we'll be back with a brand new series. I'd like to thank the following people for today's episode: Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Telhan, our executive producer.